All right, good morning, historians around the internet. Welcome back to the Old History Podcast. Adjust my microphone here. Last weekend, I did not make a podcast. Apologize for that, but I was really busy. Friday, Dr. Warren Doctor was in town, and we went to visit Rural Mount. Normally, I try to pre-record the podcast, but I figured I could use a break. And then Saturday, of course, I had to work. And then Sunday, went and filmed two houses. One of them was the Ripley Stone House up in Afton. And the other one was the David Rankin House, which is about 3/4 of a mile away from it in another area, but still in Afton. If you haven't seen the video, it's really cool. But the Ripley Stone House is like, it's got 2-foot-thick exterior walls. The MPS report described them as double masonry limestone walls with yellow poplar floor joists that are about 30 inches thick. So that house ain't going nowhere anytime soon. So I was just a wee bit busy. So outside of that, nothing really new going on, as far as I know anyway. Just going to keep sharing some pictures. Next video I find or whatever, or next thing I find a film, I'll definitely be for posting that. I'm thinking about trying to find some old barns and just take some pictures of them. Maybe there's a mill up somewhere in Greene County I'm going to try and find. I don't know. We'll just see what happens. Alright, so before we get into the podcast, remember you can subscribe to it here on Anchor for like 99 cents a month. It's not required. My payment is knowing that somebody somewhere has learned something. Maybe made somebody think. And also go visit my good friend Jason at The Beard Guy and Friends. So, let's dive right in. Alright, so we're getting into spring, and a lot of the museums are opening back up. The Davy Crockett Museum, a tavern up here in Hamlin County, is opening back up. The Longstreet Museum is opening back up. So be sure you go and give those guys a visit. Give them some of your money, because they don't, well, you know, they don't really make a whole lot, and they go off of funding so that way they can keep going. So today we're going to get into the Civil War. I understand that's, for some people, that's a sensitive topic. However, we're going to start with John Brown's raid and basically the election of Lincoln, and, well, we won't really discuss it, but, and then the Battle of Fort Sumter. So just before, I know some, this series of podcasts might make some people mad, but I'm stating facts here from NPS.gov, battlefields.org, and a few others. So let's just all take a chill pill. All right, so John Brown's raid. On July the 3rd, 1859, John Brown arrived in Harper's Ferry, Virginia, accompanied by Oliver and Owen, his sons, and by Jeremiah Anderson. In the preceding months, he had raised money from other abolitionists and ordered weapons, pikes, and guns to be used in his war against slavery. Using an alias as Isaac Smith, he rented the Kennedy Farm about 5 miles from Harper's Ferry on the Maryland side of the Potomac River. Throughout the summer, his army gathered at the farmhouse, numbering 21 at the time of the raid, and these men stayed hidden in the attic by day, reading and writing letters, polishing the rifles, and playing checkers. To avoid being seen by neighbors, they could only come out at night. And to keep up the appearance of a normal household, Brown sent for his daughter, 15-year-old Annie, and Oliver's wife, 17-year-old Martha. The girls would prepare meals and wash clothes, and kept noisy neighbors at a distance. Brown would study maps and would confer with John Cook, who was an advanced man hidden in Harper's Ferry. He would go around the town, look at the armory operations, the train schedules, and any other information he deemed valuable to his plan. On September the 30th, Brown sent Martha and Annie home to New York, and this meant that the time was near. On Sunday, October 16th, Brown called his men together, and following a prayer, he outlined his battle plans and instructed them, quote unquote, "Men, get your arms. We will proceed to the ferry." At 8 p.m., Brown and 18 of his men advanced towards Harper's Ferry. By 10 p.m., they would take both bridges leading into the town, the U.S. Armory and Arsenal, and the U.S. Rifle Works on Hall's Island. By 12 a.m., enslavers Lewis Washington and John Alstead were taken hostages, and the people they enslaved are freed. The next day, October 17th, at 1:25 a.m., a Baltimore, Ohio passenger train would stop at the bridge, and Hayward Shepherd, a free African American and railroad employee, is shot and mortally wounded as he investigates the train's delay. Around 4 to 5 a.m., hostages are held in the armory, fire engine house, and the daylight messengers carry the alarm of a slave revolt to nearby towns. Brown seizes armory employees as they report to work. 7 a.m. that morning, the townspeople begin firing on the raiders. Groceryman Thomas Borley is killed by return fire. 10 a.m. that morning, the local militia units take positions surrounding Brown's men, cutting off escape routes. Dangerfield Newby is shot. The raider to die, Raider William Thompson, is captured under a white flag when Brown asks for a truce. Raiders Watson Brown and Aaron Stevens are shot while carrying a second flag of truce. William Lehman is killed as he attempts to escape across the Potomac River, and then U.S. citizens at 2 p.m. storm the U.S. Rifle Works. John Keggy and Jim, a formerly enslaved person, are killed. Between the rest of 2 p.m. and for the rest of the evening, another 6 or 7 people would be killed. At 11 p.m., Colonel Robert E. Lee and 90 U.S. Marines arrived by train from Washington, D.C. Oliver Brown would be shot by October 18th. And then basically, the battle ends because the rest of the raiders are killed and no hostages are injured. The rest of the raiders are killed, excuse me. 16 people would be killed in the raid, including 10 of Brown's men. He would face. Hold on, I misread something. Oliver Brown dies, not John Brown. Excuse me. So, John Brown would be captured in the raid, and he would be faced with charges of murder and conspiring with enslaved people to rebel and treason against the state of Virginia. John Brown's trial began October 27th and lasted 5 days, and jurors took only 45 minutes to reach a decision. He would be guilty of all charges. On November the 2nd, John Brown was sentenced to hang on the gallows. All 6 of Brown's captured men were tried and hanged, but 5 escaped. He was executed December 2nd, 1859, and his wife would take his body back to North Elba, New York, for burial. And then in a newspaper article, says it said, quote unquote, "The Harper's Ferry invasion has advanced the cause of this Union more than any other event that has happened since the formation of the government." At this point, hope of compromise between the North and South seemed inevitable. I'll take us a quick break here, and then we'll get into how the election of Lincoln led to the first battle of the Civil War. So in 1860, Abraham Lincoln, well, actually he'd began a campaign trail for years prior, about a year or two prior to that, and he was very staunch abolitionist, wanted to get rid of slavery, and he's noted as saying, "The country cannot exist as half free and half enslaved." And when he was elected in 1860, he was elected by a considerable margin, despite not being on many Southern ballots at all. On December 20th, 1860, which is a little over a month after the polls closed, South Carolina would secede from the Union, and six more states would follow by the spring of 1861. So, and then we, on April 12th to the 14th, the first shots of the Civil War were fired on Fort Sumter. With secession, the several federal forts, including Fort Sumter in South Carolina, suddenly became outposts in a foreign land. Abraham Lincoln made the decision to send fresh supplies to the garrisons. On April 12th, 1861, Confederate warships turned back the supply convoy to Fort Sumter and opened a 34-hour bombardment on the stronghold. The garrison would surrender on April 14th. But I mean, well, that's the Battle of Fort Sumter, but we gotta talk about it. So it marked the official beginning of the American Civil War, something that lasted 4 years and cost the lives of more than 620,000 Americans and freed 3.9 million enslaved people from bondage. Although the Civil War did not end slavery, it marked the beginning of the end for slavery. It's a misconception that it just immediately ended, because after that, some, as from what I've read, some slave owners would have to be forced to let their slaves go in later years. So, in Charleston was the birthplace of secession. So they were already angry and fed up from certain actions that happened years before. So a delegate from the state would go to Washington, D.C., and demanded the surrender of the federal military installations in the new independent Republic of South Carolina. Then President James Buchanan refuses to comply, and Charleston is the Confederacy's most important port on the southeast coast. It is defended by three federal forts: Fort Sumter, Castle Pinckney, which is 1 mile off the city's battery, and the heavily armed Fort Moultrie on Sullivan's Island. Major Anderson's command is based on Fort Moultrie, but with its guns pointed out to sea, it cannot defend a land attack. On December 26th, the people of Charleston would wake to discover that Anderson and his tiny garrison of 90 men have slipped away from Fort Moultrie to the more defensible Fort Sumter. Adding to the major's concern is his dangerously dwindling store of supplies. By January 5th, the Star of the West departs from New York with some 200 reinforcements and provisions for the Sumter garrison. As a ship approaches the Charleston harbor on January 9th, cadets from the Citadel fire, forcing the crew to abandon its mission. On March the 1st, Jefferson Davis orders Brigadier General P.G.T. Beauregard to take command of the growing Southern forces in Charleston. On April 4th, Abraham Lincoln informs Southern delegates that he intends to attempt to resupply Fort Sumter, as its garrisons is now critically in need. To South Carolinians, any attempt to reinforce Fort Sumter means war. Now, the issue, quote unquote, of battle is to be forced upon us, declared the Charleston Mercury. They would go on to say, quote unquote, we will meet the invader, and the god of battles must decide the issue between the hostile hirelings of abolition hate and northern tyranny. By April 9th, Jefferson Davis and the Confederate cabinet decide to strike a blow. Davis would order P.G.T. Beauregard to take Fort Sumter. The next day, three of Beauregard's aides sail to the fort and courteously demand the garrison surrender. Anderson is equally courteous but refuses. He says, "I have the honor to acknowledge the receipt of your communication demanding the evacuation of this fort, to say in reply thereto that it is a demand with which I regret to say my sense of honor and my obligations to my government prevent my compliance." He also informs his delegation that the garrison supply will only last until April 15th. And then by April 12th, at 4:30 in the morning, a flaming mortar is shot into the air and explodes over Fort Sumter. On this signal, Confederate guns from fortifications and floating batteries around Charleston Harbor roar to life. Outmanned, outgunned, and undersupplied, and nearly surrounded on every angle by enemy batteries, Robert Anderson waited until around 7 a.m. to respond. Captain Abner Doubleday volunteers to fire the first cannon at the Confederates, a 32-pound shot that bounces off the roof of the iron battery on Cummings Point. For nearly 36 hours, the two sides keep up this unequal contest. A shell strikes the flagpole of Fort Sumter, and the American colors fall to the earth, only to be hoisted back up and hastily, only to be hoisted back up the hastily repaired pole. Confederates would fire hot shot from Fort Moultrie into Fort Sumter, and the buildings began to burn within the fort. With no more resources, Anderson surrenders Fort Sumter to Confederate forces. The next day, April 13th at 2:30 in the evening, Major Anderson and his men strike their colors to prepare to leave the fort. Sadly, the only casualties at Fort Sumter come during the 100-gun salute, when a round explodes prematurely, killing Private Daniel Hugh and mortally wounding another soldier. This attack is over, but the war had just begun. So, following the evacuation of Major Anderson and his federal garrison on the afternoon of April 14th, Fort Sumter is occupied initially by Confederate troops of Company B of the 1st South Carolina Artillery Battalion and a volunteer company of the Palmetto Guard, a local militia unit. The fort remains in Confederate hands for the next 4 years until all Confederate forces evacuate Charleston on the evening of February 17th, 1865. Despite having surrendered, Anderson and his men are greeted as heroes when they disembark in New York. Captain Abner Doubleday notes later that all the passing steamers saluted us with their steam whistles and bells. Cheer after cheer went up from the ferry boats and vessels in the harbor. Anderson's valor during the attack and commitment to duty are praised by the Union. Beauregard is also hailed for this first Confederate victory. He is also later ordered to direct the troops at Bull Run. And so, these are from battlefields.org, whitehouse.gov, mps.gov. I did not write these. Full credit to whoever wrote them. So, that's the beginning of the Civil War. I don't really want to get into the politics of it, because I know how hot some of that stuff is for some people. So, and from here on out, we'll discuss the battles and maybe some important actions that happened to steer the course of the war. With all that being said, have a good Saturday. I'll see you guys next weekend.